Dr. Veronica Anderson is an MD, and for her that means many dimensions. She's a surgeon, a mother, a black belt, and a two-time marathon runner, here to talk to you about your health, your happiness, and your world. It's Wellness for the Real World with Dr. Veronica.
It's Dr. Veronica, and tonight we're going to talk erotica. We have some real hot things that are going to happen on Wellness for the Real World coming up today. And I'm sure you're saying, Dr. Veronica, why are you always talking about sex? Because what else is there? Is there anything else in life besides sex? I mean, we work so we can have sex. We eat so we can have sex. We do everything so we can have sex. But let me just tell you that what spawned this show is there's been a couple things going on in our culture, in our society, around the world now. There's this new hot book, and I'm not quite sure why it's so hot, Shades of Gray, E.L. James. And if you haven't heard about it, it cost a lot on Amazon, so I haven't read it, because I'm just like, that's too much. It's called Mommy Porn. And the other thing that happened, while I'm hearing about the mommy porn, everybody's talking, I'm saying, what the F is mommy porn, okay? I read this article by some of my fellow HuffPost bloggers saying, these are two women, a mother and daughter writer, journalist, who write that they need a housewife. And I said at times that I've needed a housewife, but we also think about men doing equal work in a house, and what about if we had a house husband for us busy career women? How would that go over? Well, I decided, that's not going to go over in my life, not for financial reasons, but because house husbands are just not sexy. They are not sexy, okay? Now, let me just tell you something else that happened. They say that women have submission and rape fantasies, and they say that us professional working women have submission and rape fantasies. Now, I'm going to bring on one of my favorite guests in a moment, Reed Lance Rosenthal. You know him as a radio host, as a best-selling author. He has a new bestseller he's going to talk about, and I wanted to hear his take on these erotic submission fantasies that supposedly us working powerful women have. Now, back to Shades of Gray. The reason why I'm thinking about Shades of Gray, they call it mommy porn, and I'm looking and saying, what's so erotic about this book? Well, guess what? Reed Lance Rosenthal, who writes on the border of erotica, he's going to tell us about what people are finding sexy about his newest best-selling book, Maps of Fate. But he's also going to weigh in about what he knows about women and erotica. Because let me just tell you, Reed Lance Rosenthal, who's one of my favorite men in the world, he really is, has a rabid female fan base. Whenever I say Reed, women just like get wet, okay? Reed knows what I'm talking about. Women just look at Reed and say, oh, Reed, oh, my God. So if we are having these erotic submission fantasies, what kind of men are they with? Are those the men that are, like, you know, helping us with the housework? Or are they the Reed Lance Rosenthals of the world? So, Russell, wait a second. Got to bring in my co-host, Russell, first. Russell, how are you?
I'm fine, Veronica. And you know, hey, I'm not sure everyone agrees with you. You know, I'm a busy career girl, and I wouldn't mind having a house husband. I think it would be sexy as hell to have my house clean or my laundry done when I get home. It's something to eat that I don't have to figure out.
We're going to talk about that a little. We're going to talk about this needing a housewife type thing. We say we want our men to do equal work. I mean, I got a great answer for that, but rape fantasies. Do you have any rape fantasies, Russell?
I think I'll take the fifth on that one. I'd have to... which side of the rape are you speaking of, Veronica?
I just, you know, in my life, that has been quite exciting. I don't want to reveal too much.
Apparently.
I can't reveal too much because I don't want, like, women trying to, you know, grope up on my husband. But he's good. But let's pull in our friend Reed.
Let's do that. Reed Lance Rosenthal, he is He is a rancher, a genuine rancher out west, and he hosts a talk show on webtalkradio.net called On the Right Side, and as Veronica said, he's a romance novelist of all things. He wrote the bestseller Threads West, an American Saga, and book two of that series is out, Maps of Fate. Reed Lance Rosenthal, welcome to Wellness for the Real World.
It's great to be on. I'm glad we're not on TV because, like, I'm bright red right now. So, you know.
No, you are not bright red.
Oh, I am. I am. You guys have absolutely twisted me.
Yes.
I got twisted panties.
Twisted panties that you've taken off some woman, I'm sure. So,
well,
Reed,
we don't
first,
go there.
First, I want to congratulate Reed. If you do not know, audience, and you have not heard about Reed Lance Rosenthal, you are really behind the curve. Maps of Fate, book two of the Thread West American Saga is out. It is already a bestseller. And the characters in this book are really interesting. And I want Reed for you to tell us just a little bit of background about how you started writing romance novels and why your novel has been called, compared to Lonesome Dove. And I think, that didn't the Lonesome Dove guy give you a endorsement or something like that?
Well, actually, the second book of the series, Maps of Fate, which released April 17th, is endorsed the only time he's ever done it by Max McCoy, the writer of Indiana Jones and Spielberg's Into the West.
So ah, okay.
That was pretty cool. And the book itself, you know, is the second of 16 in the series. You know, the tale begins with the disparate threads of lies from uncommon origins, Europe, America, you know, in 1855 in book one, Threads West. And it's kind of the tale of how these lives intertwine into the tapestry of an emerging nation and how they come to America. And then Maps of Fate is their journey west. And, you know, the relationships between the various characters evolve both romantically and in terms of enmity and in terms of treachery and in terms of courage. And they suffer, you know, shall we say, lethal circumstances along the way. Many readers have told me, you know, on one hand, they are excited to see their husband or their husband. It's about 40% male readership, which is great. There's plenty of testosterone in this book. But you know, they tell me that it evokes emotions. You know, it evokes the sensual side of them, and the husbands and wives are glad of that night. And it evokes, you know, I can't tell you how many letters I've gotten about people who have cried at various parts of the book. So, you know, I think it's a job of an author to evoke emotion, to get people involved in the lives of their characters, to have them relate to the characters and have them relate to the story. And I write romance because it's one of the universal energies. I mean, who listening to this show has never had a romance of any type? Nobody. Everybody has had a romance. Some good, some bad, but everybody has had one. And you know, that's a universal energy, and the American spirit, which is what this book is about. The last book will be in the real time of the contemporary West. The first is in 1855, so you have five generations, an epic saga. The American spirit is a universal energy, and the land, you know, the power and energy of the land, which is kind of the anvil upon which these personalities are forged, that is a universal energy. So the book is of universal energies, and that's, I think, why it appeals. It's amazing. I have kids who are 16 years old writing me letters saying, this is terrific, where's book three? And I have old codgers who are 90 years old writing me letters saying, you know, better than Louis L'Amour or Louis L'Amour with Steam, when's the next book? So it's very cool as an author.
So Steam, let's talk about some of that Steam, because I know that you've done a lot of writing, and right on more of the steamy side of things. So I want you to weigh in on these arguments that we're having about, and maybe I don't know what's coming up in your novels.
Well, I'm not sure I'm going to touch Russell's arguments.
We have this debate in culture right now about what women like sexually, okay? And so women are very emotional. It's all in their mind, and we find it okay when it has a storyline behind it and there's sex in it, okay, and there's love and all, you know, the romance. We don't find it okay when our husbands are sitting watching it on TV with some, you know, enhanced woman. What's going on right now, though, with what women are wanting as far as you can see? Because you are, you and your novels are just very popular. What are working women saying, come take me? What's going on?
send picture, please. Anyway.
Don't do that.
You know, look. The bottom line is, I really believe that women in a sexual sense are looking for the same thing that women have always looked for. They just verbalize it more. I mean, it's more out there right now. But, you know, I mean, they're looking for the hot, passionate physical. But I think that they're looking for the emotional wedge, and I think they're looking for the mental connection. You know, I call it making love, right? I think women like to make love.
No.
And make love involves all those dimensions. Pure, raw sex, and, you know, those of us who have been lucky enough to experience that, I mean, it can be great once in a while. But, you know, let's face it, it's kind of empty. It's a fleeting high, and it's not something that kind of stays and lingers and caresses your soul like making love does.
So this mommy porn thing where you got, like, you know, a 20-year-old with this old weird guy, he's not old, but that's going on in Shades of Grey. What do you think the appeal is of that?
I think the appeal really is that it's different. I really do. I mean, I think that is the major appeal of that series, which was brilliantly put together and brilliantly marketed from its covers on down. And, you know, those books are really kind of built around, I'll use your term, the mommy porn. But I think that a book, and this is not casting any aspersions on Shades of Grey, thing is doing great. But I think a good book has a story, right? I think there's a story and there's characters that people can relate to, and I think the sexiest type of romance, number one, I'm a romance writer. It doesn't end with a long, deep kiss in the shadows of the moon, and then the next paragraph, and it was the next morning and the birds were chirping and they were having coffee. You know, I write the paragraphs in between. and the paragraphs in between, I think women are looking for, but they're looking for it in the context of a story. And it can be brutal. I mean, there's some brutal scenes in my books. You know, there's not good people that inhabit the earth everywhere, and bad people manifest themselves, and there are times that women are victims. And that happens in these books because it happens in real life. So I think the closer an author can come to real life, in my opinion, the better the story, and the more long-term the story will have appeal. And I think that in the case of Shades of Grey, I mean, I think it's a novelty. I think it has some steamy passages. I think it's a very different approach to the display of sex. And, you know, it kind of reminds me in a way of that. It gives me the same feeling of Lost Tango in Paris. Did you see that?
No, but...
Well, Lost Tango in Paris, you know, is a Marlon Brando film. And at the end of the film, I never did read the book, but at the end of the film, which I understand parallels the book, you come away with this kind of morbid, fascinated, but morbidly detached feeling. And from what I understand, that's similar kind of approach.
The type of men that women like, are women becoming more accepting of the house husband type men? Do we like really men who are in relationships that are very egalitarian from what you can see?
No, I don't think so. I really don't. I think in their heart of hearts, a man is a man and a woman is a woman, period. And, you know, all this nonsense that's spouted about this, that, and the other, and equality this and equality that, that's great. You know, there's plenty of women who are smarter than a lot of men. But in the end, a man is a man and a woman is a woman, and they're very different creatures. And I think a woman, through a million years of evolution, is looking for the security, the strength, the support of a man. And I think a man is looking for the companion, the sounding board, and both of them are looking for that fire, you know, that physical fire between them. So I don't think the house dad thing, I mean, unfortunately in this economy, and we won't go there, Veronica, but unfortunately in this economy, you know, there's guys who don't, they're not working. And, you know, the gal is working and she's supporting the family, and he needs to stay home and do those things. And that's unfortunate, but I don't think it makes, she may appreciate it, but I don't think, my personal opinion is she probably doesn't find him sexier because of it.
Okay. Now, on that note, we're going to bring in some venerated, learned doctors who study this type of thing. And let's talk to a returning guest for our show. Russell, why don't you introduce our next guest?
Yes, indeed. excuse me. And before I do, I just want to say, Reed, I'll just throw this in there. I'm a man. I have a homosexual who's to men. In my relationships, nobody decides who's the man or who's the woman. I mean, there isn't that kind of thing going on. I know male couples who, and for that matter, male-female couples, who literally take turns at working for 2 years, you know, and then the other one stays home and the other one goes back to their career for 2 years. You know, people come up with all kinds of arrangements that nobody thought of before. So I don't know.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Russell. I was really talking about the arrangement that's forced because of economic realities right now. You know, where it's not a voluntary, you sat down and you decided this is, whatever mix the couple is, you didn't sit down and decide voluntarily this is the way it was going to be. You're forced by necessity. And I just don't think, you know, I don't think that that stimulates sexiness.
I get you.
Question is how you fix that given the lean times that we're in and could be in for a long time, with Krugman saying it really is a depression and we're not getting out of it. So can we talk to the psychologist now?
Yeah, it's definitely sexier to have money coming in.
Or the neuroeconomist, I should say.
Yes, Dr. Paul Zak is returning to us. He had an op-ed piece in just yesterday's Wall Street Journal. He's the author of a book coming out very soon, The Moral Molecule, and he is the discoverer of the hormone oxytocin. Dr. Paul Zak, thanks for being with us on Wellness for the Real World.
Thank you, Russell. Hi, Veronica. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for coming back. Okay. This oxytocin, the way women like sex, working women wanting it to be raped. I want you to weigh in on all this. What's going on in the neurochemistry of love, sex, vis-a-vis women, and why are people finding these novels like Shades of Grey so stimulating?
Right. So Reed mentioned testosterone, which, as you know, is a hormone that both men and women make and is strongly associated with sex drive. And what evolution has done for us is when we're successful, we get a bump in testosterone and at the same time, therefore, a bump in sex drive. So if a woman is working and she is successful and she gets promotions and raises, her brain is telling her, hey, baby, you got the best genes on the planet. Everybody should be wanting to mate with you. And guys for the same thing, right? And so what testosterone does in experiments we run in my lab is makes people more selfish and more entitled. So we know this. Who are the most selfish, entitled people on the planet? Teenage boys, you know, which Russell, Lyon, Reed used to be. So you always have this imbalance. So if your spouse is at home and he or she is not getting the kind of social strokes on, you know, doing great, you know, then there's going to be a kind of a physical misbalance on how much sex is wanted. Having said that, you know, sometimes all you want to do is come home and have someone be nice to you and fix you a meal and, you know, lie down next to you in bed. So, as Russell said, I think there's a large variety of potential behaviors, but, you know, it's inevitable that our brains are going to have a mismatch for most people.
So us women who are out here working in the world feel like we come home. I don't feel like there's a whole lot. Well, yes, I have. In my last marriage, I felt like it. But I feel like that we come home and we just need help in the house. We just need help. And there's something where this mismatch is going on, no matter how egalitarian we've become in the workforce for a lot of us. It just doesn't seem to be equal at home. Can you explain that from a neurochemistry standpoint?
I can. That's a great question. And so I read recently that even for women who work, they still do about 75% of the housework, whether their husband works or not. So, you know, this is kind of unfair. So this is where oxytocin and testosterone come into play. So oxytocin is this bonding chemical that makes us care about people, from our spouses to our children to even complete strangers. And one of the sexiest turn-ons is someone who is generous. So we want someone who's going to care for us. And so something guys can do at home is, you know, clean up the house. Do something nice for your wife so that she actually gets a break. And that can be a turn-on because it says, not only do I want to kind of ravish you right now, testosterone, I want to be with you long-term. So oxytocin is this long-term love chemical. So it moves us out of lust, which is very important, into kind of long-term connection and care. And learning how to modulate those two desires in your own relationship is a real art.
So what would you say? I mean, I just think, like Reed says, men are going to be men, and it's never going to be equal in the home. But on top of it not being equal, I personally feel like I don't want it to be equal. I want my man to be a man, and if he doesn't clean up as well, that's fine. Now, I'm going away for a couple of days, and I know when I come back, the hot house will be spotless when I go on those trips. And he does it better than me because he's a perfectionist, and so it's wonderful. But when we're going day to day, I'm lifting the load more than he's lifting the load. And it doesn't really bother me a whole lot. I don't know why. It doesn't bother me. So why do you think that some of us are saying, oh, it's not such a big deal, and why are you struggling about it? And, okay, so let me tell you what my real answer to this is. But before we talk about the real answer is, we got to bring in our next guest because this, when I read this in the Huffington Post, I was like, okay, yes, I feel that way, but Barbara and Shannon Kelly, HuffPost bloggers, wrote a blog, Who Wants a Housewife? And I remember that line in there about wearing the jogging clothes that were hadn't been washed for 3 days. And I was like, oh, my God. But I have to. Is that Shannon? Is that you, Shannon, on the line?
Well, actually,
that's
it's me, Barbara.
I have Barbara and Shannon.
Both of us.
Okay, welcome, Barbara and Shannon. This is a mother-daughter team. They are writers. I know they have a book, and well, I'm going to let you mention the book in a second. But
okay.
Oh my God! I said okay. I've often said I would love to have a housewife, somebody to do the work for me. But what I also said is, okay, this is an easily solved problem. Delegate. When I'm doing stuff at work, delegate. And so you say, well, how do you delegate? Well, you got kids, you delegate to them. If you're working, put it in your budget to hire somebody to do the stuff for you. Just hire somebody to do it and be done with it. I have a cleaning lady that comes in and washes my clothes every week, so I don't like arguing with my husband about it. It's stuff that gets done. Go to Gennardi's. Get the meals that are already prepared. You can get things like that now. So tell us what spurred you to write Who Wants a Housewife? Tell everybody about that.
Well, I'll go first. This is Barbara. I had just come back from teaching a class to a bunch of college seniors, and one of them was doing some research on why there aren't more women leaders in the world and, you know, how hard it is for women to ascend to the ranks of, you know, up the corporate ladder. And there are a few males in the class, and I said, well, you know, sometimes – you know, if you're running a household, if you have kids, it's really hard for two people to go gangbusters on their career. And everybody nodded. And then I said, well, to the guys, what about you? Would you ever stay home if your husband, if your wife had a good job? And they looked at me like I had just, you know, started spouting fire or something. It was like, oh, it's a great idea in theory, but I'm not going to do that. And that kind of got me thinking.
So what do you think that the women, when you were talking to them, wanted men who were going to stay home? Because that's just totally unsexy to me. I mean, theoretically, I'd like somebody to help me with the work. But on the other side of things, I'm just that's just unsexy. So what were the women saying about this?
I think it was mixed. It wasn't whether or not it would be the men would be sexy, but it sure would be nice to have somebody going into a marriage thinking, oh, I'm willing to share 50-50.
Yeah, but everybody says that when they're going. And they're young, before you have the kids, before the careers are going crazy. I mean, when I was in my marriage before, I had my own medical practice. I was in the operating room operating, and the school would call me about something for the kids. I'm like, he's sitting at his desk. I'm operating on somebody's eyes. Call him. Okay? They still, mom's going to be called. But on the other hand, let's just talk about what happens, because you guys also talk about mommy wars. I think your most recent blog was about mommy wars. The other thing that happened is women who didn't work would come in my office in the middle of the day and put guilt trips on me because I was a working mother. What's going
on
there?
That's terrible.
Well.
Yeah, that is terrible. This is Shannon, and I wrote the Mommy Wars piece that you're talking about, and it never seems to die, you know, it won't go away. And one, you know, and it's kind of been rehashed and rehashed from every angle, but I read an interesting piece by Megan Daum in the LA Times yesterday. And her take was really interesting. It was like our society is just so work and kind of achievement-oriented that we have to frame parenting in that same kind of way in order to make it legitimate. And that's why, you know, that has something to do with, like, the competitiveness that you see.
Okay. Well, you say the competitiveness between working women who work outside the home versus women who work in the home. Is that a politically correct way to say it?
Yeah, and I also think just between women who are moms and, like, the way how they mother, you know.
I think that's exactly right. They're competing to be who's the best mommy too.
Okay. So now let's shift this over though. To what's going on from the kitchen to the bedroom. What do you feel that women really would love to have a man that stays home, does the work, and are going to feel as attractive about him? I know you guys have sort of delved in a lot of things. What have you found?
Well, you know, interesting. One of the sources for our book is Myra Strober, who is an economist at Stanford who teaches in the business school. And she has been teaching this class called Work and Family for years and years and years. And she says, you know, she has probably equal numbers of men and women in her classes now. And she says kind of what you are saying is that women who want high-powered careers, and that's all that's in the Stanford Business School, really don't find men to be very sexy if they don't want high-powered careers as well, which ends up to be a problem because then, you know, they're both climbing the ranks to the corporate suite and then they have a kid or two and they realize we can't do this. And so one of them steps off the track. One of them has to. And it usually is the woman.
And now what do you think happens? Well, let's go back. What's happening in the bedroom as a result of this? Is there tension and stuff like that?
I would think whoever's taking off work to, you know, deal with carpool and packing lunches and laundry and cleaning the house is probably not feeling it that much.
This is what I mean, I've been told.
Yeah. I mean, I get what you're saying about, you know, like the whole Mr. Mom idea not being that sexy. And, you know, and maybe it's not, but also I think, like, the actual being of the housewife not make one feel very sexy either. So I think the answer is that we all have hired help. That's, like, that's impossible.
Well, I think that if when you work that you should just put that in your budget. I mean, they have maids and all these other things that are out here now that make it affordable. So part of the budget should be when you sit down and say, okay, let's just be honest with everybody. Nobody's going to all do the work. You're not going to help halfway, even though we want to idealistically say it's going to be that way. Therefore, how are we going to not have this argument and just put it in the budget to hire the help? That's what my answer is. Everybody can push back on me about that. But you know what I want to do? I want you guys to hang on.
Okay.
I had to bring on some house husbands because I want to know how they felt about being house husbands.
Hooray.
In the capacity of house husbands.
I was just kidding. I think house husbands are very sexy. I was just kidding.
To beat me up, beat us all up. Now, I want to hear from somebody who's been a house husband and find out a couple of things. One, what is it like being a house husband? How did it evolve? But also, did it do anything to the sex life? I know one of the gentlemen said he ended up divorced because his wife didn't like it so much. So, Russell, jump in so that we can interview some of these people. You can hear the voice of men who've done this.
We have with us first Frank Domenico Cipriani. He's a writer for BDNews24.com. He's co-authored a book, Learning Little Hawk's Way of Storytelling. And Frank, welcome to Wellness for the Real World. Tell us about
your
experiences.
Okay, well, first of all, it was, 22 years ago, we made this decision that my wife decided that, you know, to drive her crazy to stay home. And she was really, really a good worker. And I'm sort of, I don't like bosses. So we decided early on that, you know, I was the better candidate to stay home. Having said that, the word house husband or Mr. Mom is in and of itself really super unsexy. I mean,
yeah.
I would say I'm a full-time dad.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a huge distinction because I'm a terrible, terrible, terrible house cleaner. In fact, we have a very big household, and we keep bringing people in. You know, I'm sort of like, you know, can we keep them? Can we keep them? So we have a very big household. We have 10 people in the house.
Whoa.
And so I couldn't really hire somebody to come in every week and help clean. And I was also homeschooling my kids, so in both ways, it was a little difficult to do that. So I hired somebody who was a cleaner to come in and give me cleaning lessons. And so she would take me on what she would have done each week because I didn't know what to do. And she tried to teach me how to clean. And it turns out that it requires a huge amount of being a shrew on the part of the person at home to make sure that everyone's, you know, not leaving the room dirty, they're picking up after themselves. And I thought, well, you know, I mean, I'd rather my kids be studying, let's say, Hungarian or you know, or we ran together. I gave my kids, I promised them a party if they could run in miles the number of years old they were.
Wow.
So, yeah, my 7-year-old did it. It was awesome. I could barely keep up, but
wow.
It was really sort of an exciting time. On the same token, everything that you guys have said pretty much is true, that it didn't really work so well romantically. so we
now
became
tell us about that evolution of what happened. First, you thought this is a good idea. I'm a better suited one to stay home. You even went out to get somebody to help you figure out how to manage the household duties better, and you suffered in the bedroom. What? How did that evolve?
I think, you know, I hate to say it's a matter of programming. I really do. And I would not replace that that time, you know, the time that I could spend with my kids through those years for anything. I think that they're really, really well-evolved kids because of it. And I would hope my children, sort of my daughters, would do the same, that they would not sacrifice what they thought of as their destiny to do all this. At the same time, as the days go by, you know, the standards change. That, you know, you measure your success by what's going on the inside, and she's sort of measuring her success about what's going on the outside. It becomes so family-like that you end up being more siblings. And in fact, that's pretty much what happened. We ended up being like a brother and a sister. And so, you know, our romantic relationship sort of ended at that point, although we still live together, we're still married, we still have the kids, but romantically we're divorced and we have other people in our lives, wonderful people who understand the whole deal. But it's...
That's a whole other show. That is a whole
other
show.
Yeah, it's a whole other show.
We're going to do that next week. I'm sorry, I have to chime in because I talk about different paradigms of relationships. And wait, we got to have conservative Reed L. Rosenthal jump in, who's a romance writer, to talk about this other paradigm. I didn't even know I was going to get this Reed. Reed, jump in. But, you know, see what's going on.
I happen to agree. I think all your guests today are saying the same thing. You know, a man is a man, a woman is a woman. We may differ on whether it's evolution, we may differ on whether it's training, we may differ on whether it's brainwashing, but in the end, you know, a man is a man and a woman is a woman. And, you know, Russell, in your case, whether or not you designate who is the man and who is the woman, I mean, there's still roles that each of you kind of fulfill within your relationship. And I think that that's a truism. And I don't think you get around it, no matter how you slice or dice the pie.
Okay, so now we have another gentleman here also who has played in the you're talking about house husband. Everybody hates that term. I'm not quite a stay-at-home dad. I don't know what to call it. I'm not trying to be offensive to anybody, but
You know, depending upon the gal, Veronica, I mean, if she really likes house husbands, I could be like a house husband for a day.
Can we do a contest on that? I have people beating down my door to get you to be the house husband.
Sure.
I'm telling you.
Kind of.
I'll post that on my Twitter feed, and I'll be like, it'll like turn to shut down Twitter and Facebook with the Reed will be your house husband for a day. So let's get on. I want to get on another gentleman who's with us who has also played more of a role in the house rather than in the workforce and see how that evolved. Russell?
Yeah, we also have with us another author. He's an astrologer, and he's written a book called Alchemy Astrology. Tim Wilkerson is with us. Tim, you're on Wellness for the Real World.
Hello.
Hi, Tim. How are you? Okay, first of all, for my own knowledge, what is alchemy?
Alchemy is the precursor to chemistry, the study of natural elements and how to use them for health and kind of like herbalism.
Ah, okay. All right, so alchemist, astrologer. Let me know.
Make gold out of metal, no?
Yeah, transmuting base metals to gold is the ultimate goal of the alchemist. I'm working on it.
Okay.
I can stay home all I want. Yeah.
Well, if you make the gold. But tell us about your stay-at-home role and how that evolved.
Well, I've always had my own business, small business, to keep me going. And like your previous guests, I don't really like bosses. I don't do well working for other people, so I've always had my own businesses. And when I first married, and eventually we had a son, and we both had our own businesses. It kind of evolved into she wanted me to go out and be a banker or something impossible for me, and that created a struggle, but I did my best to stay home and take care of our son, and she didn't like it well, so it didn't work out. But the woman that I'm with now just loves it. She's an ICU nurse, a career woman, and I would stay home with my stepdaughters and help with raising them. Unlike your previous guest, I also was I'm very good at house cleaning. I was raised by my mom, the oldest of six kids, so I had lots of training early on. And then I went in the military, and that's a big focus of the military is they teach you to clean, to teach you discipline. So I had no problem with that. So I run the household. I do a large percent of the cooking, probably 70%. I do all the laundry. I do all the grocery shopping. I do take care of the cars. You know, I make sure they're maintained and things. So basically, that's what I do. I was a stay-at-home dad. Now the kids are grown up. They're pretty much in college. I've got one more in high school who's working on getting that finished up.
Okay, so tell me about when the kids were younger. I see it. Okay, you did it. You did it how, if we had our husbands do it, we want it done at least. How is your relationship with your wife changing, though? And does it affect the erotic portion of your relationship that you do things this way?
Well, it did in my previous marriage, the one that didn't work out. But my wife now just loves it. And she calls me the house spouse.
House spouse. Okay, I like that better, house spouse.
Yeah.
Okay.
And she tells her friends at work about it and stuff, and they're mixed on it. You know, some of the other nurses, they're like, "Oh no, I couldn't do that." You know, and then some are going like, "Does he have a brother?" So it's kind of mixed. It took me a while to become comfortable with it, and now I don't have any problem saying, "Yeah, I stay home. I have my own. I'm authoring some books, and you know, starting that career." I also play music, so I get gigs once in a while, and it's great.
So basically the key to this is finding the woman that is okay with your role like that. And I'm assuming that your second wife knew that you were like this.
My first wife knew, too, when we first got married, but that changed. Her ideas changed. I don't know if it was peer pressure or what. But, yeah, she's perfectly comfortable with it, and she appreciates it tremendously and tells me very often how much she loves me and that she's so glad that I take such good care of her and the family. So it hasn't affected our love life at all.
Okay, now I want to bring in some of our previous guests and have them. When I saw Barbara and Shannon writing about this, I was just like, okay, we need somebody to give advice to how to orchestrate this such that it works, such that the man is helping and it works. Now, here's my personal feeling about it. You have to get the guy that's like this in the first place. I mean, so Tim is like this, and so it works. But to try to change a man into this, I don't think it's going to work. Tim, Frank, do you guys feel that there's any advice that you can give Barbara and Shannon about this and have them stay interested in their husbands from a romantic, erotic standpoint?
I'd say you just need to let go of your preconceived ideas because you're working as a team and you're friends, and the love just brings it all together. There's just so much prejudice against a man not out there being the breadwinner, and I don't see there's any reality to that anymore. I mean, the women don't need us to defend them or to fight for their honor or go out and, you know, hunt and bring home the meat or anything like that. Both of us are equally qualified to go to the grocery store and cook a meal, so I don't see the problem.
Barbara, Shannon, do you want to ask any questions?
Well, you know, I think I think one of the issues is that we're kind of talking about either or. One stays home or the other stays home. And I think for a lot of families and couples, that's an impossibility economically. So, you know, both husband and wife are working outside the home, and yet there's this whole other job of the inside the home that has to be done. And I think that's where the sticky point comes in. You know, you both come, you drag yourself home, you're both tired, you've both had a long day, and somebody has to put the dishes in the dishwasher, and somebody has to put the food on the table, and somebody has to wash the running clothes. And that's where the tough negotiation comes in, I think.
Yeah. I say hire someone, but there are things that you just got. There's maintenance thing that somebody who you're not going to get somebody that's going to do everything. You're just not going to. So there is that matter of, okay, we have to get things done, and how are we going to divide the labor? So
yeah,
I don't know what to say. You know,
I think there's
go ahead.
I think there's another point to be made. My wife definitely has a career. It pays very well. And I figured out how much money I could make if I went out, you know, and found a job I was qualified for. And all the things that I do around the house, if we hired someone to do it, it would cost us more than I could make. And a lot of couples that I've heard are like that. If one of them, the one who makes the least money, actually sat down and looked how much it costs for them to go to work, get child care, et cetera, et cetera, they'd find out that they're actually losing money. So you need to look at that. If you're both career people and you're making great money, then get a live-in nanny or someone, you know.
Oh, that is not the answer. I've been there, done that.
Hire a service,
yeah. I'm just saying, you know, when I'm saying hire someone, I've been in the situation where I have had nannies and au pairs and housekeepers and all this other type of stuff. And I will let you know that now, where I don't have to have all that stuff, is so much better. It seems like the dream. Everybody thinks they're going to get Mary Poppins. And I can tell you that I put people out of my house in the middle of the night because they were just the opposite of Mary Poppins. So,
yeah.
I mean, hiring someone, no. I mean, I say that tongue-in-cheek. This is a issue that's going to go in on and on for I don't know how long. But I just think that what happens is when you're trying to squeeze men into these roles that they're not suited for, I think Tim is suited for the role, and so it works well in his relationship, although he had a woman that her mind wasn't okay with that role. Okay, so that's why the relationship didn't work. So I think that for me, it would drive me bananas. I mean, Tim may be a nice guy. He may be this, that, and the other thing, but something about it would be like, no, you're not sleeping with me because I just do not find you sexy, because that's just not, for whatever reason. And I know it's extremely prejudiced, and I don't know how to get
well,
rid of
that. I think it's personal. You know, I think that these two house spouses that you have on, you know, they happen to be suited to living this way. Like, it suits them. It treats them well. They're happy doing it that way. And, you know, just as that is true, it has to be true for the woman who's going to be with them that they're turned on by that.
Yeah,
you know?
What we need is a way for women to figure out if they really want that and can deal with that. And then if you decide, you know what, I really want that and deal with that, to really find a man who can do that. How do you find a guy like that? It's just, it's something that people, we don't talk about that when we talk about romantic relationships. Now, we have some more professionals on, some more psychologists that we have coming up. And so I'm going to have them comment on this because they've seen all these kind of crash and burns in the couples with these type of things, both in the household, with division of labor, with who's going to work, who's not going to work, and then also all these things always, always, always manifest themselves in the bedroom because generally people use sex as a weapon rather than sex as something that's for love. So, Russell.
You know, I have a suggestion, Veronica, for the house dads.
Go ahead.
Make sure you greet her at the door. Make sure you're wearing chaps with no underwear, your shirtless with a cowboy hat, and a broom in your right hand, and say, "Hey, baby, welcome home."
I'm just a bad
Well, you know,
bitch.
I do like the broom.
you know what, Reed? You're going to have to send a picture just like that for us to post.
Yeah, oh, yeah, you bet.
Russell, do you have a comment before you introduce our next guest?
Well, yeah. You know, I think, you know, if we listen to how we're talking about this, we're kind of stacking our own opinions, really. When we use a word like housewife or house husband, I mean, it's a role we associate with femininity. So to put a man in that role makes us, you know, assume there's some kind of loss of manhood. You know, it's like you wouldn't call a man a maid. You wouldn't call a man, you know, a housewife.
But I don't think either one is sexy. I don't think a housewife has sexy to it either. Like, they both kind of imply a housekeeper.
That's why,
yeah,
I like house spouse.
For you, what do we think of male secretaries? Sexy?
No.
Well, it depends on what they look like.
Here either.
They're 25 and got a hot bod, yeah.
Yeah, you know.
I think that was when we came up with the term administrative assistant.
Exactly.
Right. Yes. And mail carrier, not mail.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we have with us now a very interesting gentleman. Dr. David Lay is with us. He writes for Psychology Today. He's been on, you've seen him on Dr. Phil, the Anderson Cooper Show. He's the author of two books that have gotten a lot of attention: Insatiable Wives, Women Who Stray and the Men Who Love Them, and most recently, The Myth of Sex Addiction. Dr. David Lay, hi, and welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Dr. Lay, see, you're like the other Reed. Reed is like the romance writer, and you're like writing books that are true or based on true characters that sounds like Reed ought to read your book so he can get more fodder for his romance novel. Insatiable
Wives.
For
his fantasy, sure.
Insatiable Wives. What? Tell us about Insatiable Wives, because we're sitting here, we're listening to women are reading these erotic novels, but on the other hand, we're complaining that we don't have enough help in the house, and Insatiable Wives. And insatiable, I mean, men are never called insatiable. I think that's a sexist term right there. That implies, like, that you're just promiscuous and crazy and wild. And go ahead. Tell us about Insatiable Wives.
You know, Insatiable Wives came out of a couple of couples that came into my office and were doing some work with me. And both couples, the wives, were seeing other men. The couples had an arrangement where the wives were not monogamous, and the man and the husbands were, and they were okay with it. I got to say, when I first heard that, I thought, wow, that's crazy. How can that work? But both of these couples, interestingly enough, had been together for 30 years or more. They had remarkably healthy relationships. It really forced me to confront some of my own assumptions. So I spent a year and a half interviewing couples around the country, talking to these couples where the wives' sexuality really drove the marriage and drove the arrangements that they had made. And I heard some fascinating stories. You know, the title Insatiable Wives really kind of comes out of, you're right, historically, female sexuality has been viewed as something that can't be satisfied. And historically, that was something that was seen as a bad thing. It was seen as something that had to be suppressed. But in these couples, they decided that the infinite capacity of female sexuality was something to celebrate. And so when the husband decided, well, you know, my wife's sexual capacity is too great for me to satisfy, he then went out and got other men to help him.
Okay. Now, do you think that most women really are like this and desire it, but they just can't practice it because it's just not permitted, it's not allowed? I mean, we're listening to someone, the other gentleman on the show, saying, well, our relationship became a friendship, and now we both have other people. So they have an alternate paradigm relationship. Obviously, the people you're talking about have an alternate paradigm in their relationship. But do you really think that this is just the way people are?
It's a good question, and I don't think we really know how people are. I think we know how people are with the cultural programming that we're given. And in these couples, I would say 99.9% of them, the idea for this, the spark for this, came from the husbands. Wives and women are not really told in our culture that it's okay for them to be monogamous because, you know, women who are cheat stand the risk of losing their husbands, losing the support, losing the caregivers, losing the fathers for their children, and they suffer significant consequences. So I don't think it is okay for women to really entertain those ideas. But interestingly enough, as the men raise these ideas, you know, one of the things that is reported in swinger couples often is that the man brings up the idea, the women keep it going. Because what I've heard from over and over and over from women all over the country with this is that it allows them to connect with their sexuality and with their attractiveness in a way that they never really felt like they could. Having the safety of their husband, having the safety of that kind of relationship, allowed them to start then connecting with who they were at an erotic level, and being attractive to other men. One woman I'll never forget what she said. She said, you know, my husband tells me I'm attractive, but that's his job. When another man tells me I'm attractive, it makes me feel unbelievable. Sexy.
Interesting. So, but see, what I'm thinking is that the reason why women are eating up romance novels and all these type of things is because this is just really the nature of women. Well, women tend to be more polyamorous than men. However, we haven't been allowed. And I think that even religious laws have been made to keep women's sexuality in check. What do you say about that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the history of polyandry, you know, women with multiple husbands, is incredibly rare. And in Insatiable Wives, I talk about a couple of examples of it. It has really only historically occurred related to economics. In cultures where the women controlled the economy, in cultures where the women controlled the money, there were higher levels of acceptability for women to have multiple men. And it's interesting because there's a current parallel. One of the things that we know, infidelity is different in men and women. In men, as their economic value goes up, as their education goes up, as their income goes up, infidelity actually goes down. But in women, as their economic value increases, as their education and their independence, their income increases, their infidelity increases. In men, when men are poor, when men are in poverty, there's high rates of infidelity. When women are poor, there's very low rates of infidelity because the poor women are dependent upon the men. And so we have to look at these things in the context of society, in the context of culture, in the context of economy. But you're right. It is something about the nature of women. And one of the things that I would like to point out is, you know, men consume pornography far more than women because pornography and internet pornography is very good at targeting the aspects of male sexuality. It's very good at targeting things like variety and stimulation, all of those things that really get at male sexual arousal. Women's erotica and romance novels do exactly the same thing for women. They target those fantasies of being dominated. They target the fantasies of the being desired by this powerful man who would not normally act this way, but is acting this way because of you, because his arousal and desire for you just carries him away. And it's all within relationship. Those are the things that target female sexuality. In some ways, you know, romance novels are female pornography, comparable to internet pornography for men.
So let's talk about a little bit. You touched on the socioeconomics. Is it that, like I said, women, their nature is more polyamorous, and when they become financially free and are not financially dependent, this is what they would really choose?
I don't know if it's what they would really choose, but it certainly is something that they do choose more. It is some, you know, it is the case that when women are not dependent upon a single man, infidelity increases. You know, one of the other interesting things, though, I think about women is that are women naturally polyamorous, you know, or are humans naturally polyamorous? I think that, you know, there is individual variation. I think, you know, different people are more disposed to monogamy than others, even by their genes. You know, cheating is 40% heritable. You know, if you have an identical twin and you cheat, there's 40% chance that your identical twin will commit infidelity as well. So all of this stuff comes along in our genes and our programming and everything else. But there's something interesting with women. Women's ovulation cycles, and maybe some of your guests have already talked about this, but women's ovulation cycles predict something interesting about their response to men. When a woman is not ovulating, she is more attracted to men who are good husbands, more attracted to men who are good fathers. When a woman is ovulating, she is more aroused and more likely to cheat with a man who is not a good husband and not a good father, with the kind of man that is going to cheat, with that rounder who's always going to be running around with lots of different women, the guy who's masculine and dominant and aggressive. He's not going to take care of you, but he's going to be great in bed. And that's the kind of woman, that's the kind of man that women pursue at certain times of their cycle. At other times, they don't. So I think what we are getting at is the ability for women to start acknowledging and expressing some of those things outside of some of the social pressures for, you know, for monogamy. Women and couples are now able to negotiate arrangements from a place of self-acceptance and self-knowledge that I find really interesting. Without the, and here's the other thing, and one of the things I'm really loving about talking with you is that the majority of suppression of female sexuality actually comes from other women, not men. Men love a woman with a history. You know, the idea of a woman who is sexual turns a man on, but it is threatening to other women. And there's a fascinating study out there by a guy named Eric Bloomberg where he talks about high libido females. And he interviewed high libido females around the world, and he found that consistently they report that their closest friends are men.
Oh,
and
my God.
They're often rejected by other women because they're too sexy. Because other women, you know, view that they're kind of giving something away that is valuable. You know, there's the old saying about, you know, why, if you give away the milk for free, who's going to buy the cow?
Yeah, but we don't need anybody to buy the cow anymore because we can buy the milk for ourselves. That's
exactly.
What I think. Okay,
I think
so wait.
Precisely.
Now, I gotta touch on this other thing. This is your other area of expertise, although it's a little bit outside of our topic, but sex addiction.
Sure.
Sex addiction. You say it's a myth. I say it's a myth too. I said I did a show
on
sex addiction, and I said this is just an excuse that people use. Okay, and this one, you know, I was talking about when Tiger Woods was doing everybody, you know, Anthony Weed, oh, I'm addicted to sex. It's an excuse. However,
absolutely.
However, when I interviewed Winston Bennett, who was the former assistant coach for the Boston Celtics, he was acting like an addict. He really was the way, but I don't know if that's because he'd been told it's addiction and he read all about it and he was acting like an addict, or if he truly was addicted. Tell us about sex addiction, because you talk about on one hand insatiable wives, okay, and that implies that these women just cannot be satisfied sexually, which almost means like they're addicted, like they need it, like food or gambling or cigarettes or drugs. But then on the other side, you say, well, sex addiction is a myth. Go ahead.
You know, I really think these two things go together. I think insatiable wives and myth of sex addiction are kind of two sides of the coin, because both of them are talking about people with high libidos. You know, the idea of sex addiction is saying that male sexuality is a disease, that too much male sexuality or too much male sexual arousal is dangerous. Now, it's interesting that this is an idea that has come up only since the early 1980s. Number one, it came up as AIDS was presenting in our society, and all of a sudden, unrestrained male sexuality could result in death. And so all of a sudden, men who were too sexy, and especially men who were too sexual in non-socially acceptable ways, like bisexuality, were dangerous and deadly. Secondly, though, society has shifted. And all of a sudden, men are viewed as deficient. Men are viewed as not as strong or as capable or as moral or having as good character as women. And so men are now being held to the same standards, especially the same sexual standards, as women have been held for a long time. And all of a sudden, what do we have? We have an excuse. We have a way to say, oh, it's just because they're men. They can't control it. Now, the difference is, historically, nymphomaniacs, women who were diagnosed as being too sexy, horrible things happened to them. They got sent to institutions. They had their clitorises removed. They had lobotomies done to them. Now, men who are identified as too sexual go to a country club treatment program for 30 days, and we believe that everything is okay.
So you are saying that it's just normal male sexuality. Like, so for instance, when I watched the Tiger Woods thing, I said, he's never been able to run around like everybody else. I don't care if she looks like a model. He's tired of her, and he wants variety. Is that the way you see it, too? Is that what's happening in these cases? He's on profile. He's got, excuse me, pussy thrown at him all the day from everywhere, and he's going to partake in. Why shouldn't he?
I think it's a couple of things. One of which you're talking about. You know, men. Again, I don't mean to be a one-trick pony, but a lot of this stuff relates to hormones. A lot of this stuff relates to the neurochemicals in our body. And just as I talked about those neurochemicals with female ovulation, in men, testosterone predicts their sexual behavior, predicts their level of sexual arousal, and predicts infidelity. Now, when we look at professional athletes, we are looking at men who have been chosen to be in these high echelon activities because of the physical characteristics that come along with testosterone. Things like aggression, assertiveness, physical athleticism is predicted by testosterone. So we put these men that are already predisposed away from monogamy because of those genes and because of those characteristics, we put them in a position where, you're right, women are throwing themselves at them. And so why are we surprised when these men act these ways? Frankly, I say if we want monogamous athletes, or, God help me, if we wanted monogamous politicians, politicians and leaders, we would have lackluster athletes and we would have poor leaders. It is those qualities that make these people good at what they do that also comes along with some baggage, like infidelity. Now, the other side of it, though, is these these men that are identified as sex addicts, they're not being selfish just in sex. And, you know, there was a recent biography of Tiger Woods by his former coach. And one of the things he said in there was, you know, Tiger acted selfishly and egotistically towards other people in lots of ways. Sex was just one of them. So when we call this sex addiction, we're ignoring the whole iceberg of all these other behaviors and problems, and we're focusing just on the sex. Why? Because our society is obsessed with sex.
Which is why every other week we have a show on sex.
Yeah, absolutely. It's popular. It's one of the reasons it's one of the reasons I wrote a couple of books about it. Jeez, I get to read about it and talk about it all the time.
And so now I have to bring in, I've been giving Reed, our romance writer, some more fodder for his books. And so Reed, I have to have you jump in and comment after Dr. Lay about what you just heard.
Well, after listening to Dr. Lay, I'm never apologizing again.
For?
It's great. No, I happen to agree with everything you said. And I think that, you know, the mores of society have kind of repressed the reality. And I think that's really what he's saying. And, you know, high achievers are high achievers in all facets of their life. And with a million years of evolution, that includes mating. So I'm right on board.
And women. For men and women. It's not just men who are high achievers.
I said high achievers. I didn't attach a gender, Veronica. Take it easy.
What do you think, Reed? Do you write porn for women as a romance writer?
Well, you know, I don't consider it porn for women. I mean, it's steamy and it's erotic, and I've gotten lots of, shall we say, great comments on the reality of the scenes because I try and write realistically. You know, whether it's good sex or bad sex or love sex or you know, brutal sex, which there unfortunately is in this day and age, and there was in 1855. But you know, I think it's such a universal thing, and sex is something I would imagine everybody on the planet has engaged in at least once, that it holds a fascination. And that universal topic, you know, which Dr. Lay writes of in a non-fictional sense, and I write of in a fictional sense, it definitely draws a readership. And since it's part of life, I think it makes both the nonfiction that he writes and the fiction that I write more realistic in people's minds, and they gravitate toward that.
You know, and I think we, to a degree, we're writing about the same thing, because one of the things you write about in romance is that feeling of being swept away. Women want to be swept away. They want to give up some level of control, and I think that's part of what Shades of Grey and the popularity of it is about, is that there is some appeal, there is some eroticism to giving up control in sexuality. But that's normal and that's healthy. It's something that we all experience and it's something that we can all manage. The problem I have with sex addiction is that they believe that we don't have control over sexuality and that giving up control is dangerous and deadly and potentially destructive. But I think we all have the ability to give up some control in a sexual situation and yet still be in control of ourselves and our decisions.
Okay, now, we're talking about women a lot and sexuality, and we had a lot of male voices talking about women and sexuality. So I saved a professional woman, relationship expert, been all over the TV too, for last, because I wanted to hear a woman comment about women and sexuality and what they want from a perspective. Now, she may say, you know what, you're right. Everything they said is right. But, Russell, do the introduction so we can hear what she is going to say.
Yes, Dr. Karen Ruskin is here. She has a new book just coming out, Dr. Karen's Marriage Manual. And she's a go-to psychotherapist for Fox News Boston and Fox and Friends First. Dr. Karen, welcome to Wellness for the Real World.
Hey, thanks for having me back. You know, it's always my pleasure to be on board.
So now you've been listening to this interesting conversation where we've been talking about sex, what women want, sexuality, some problems that go on in the home, our house husband's sexy, wives that are insatiable. You got to make some commentary about all this because we're going to figure out what's going on in our bedrooms of America today.
Right. Well, there's so much to say. You really had great guests. And so as I listened intently, I have 6 points, and each one is 1 point per guest, which puts us in a total package and then a summary. So
I like
let's
it.
Go with this, right? So because there were so many topics within an overall topic. So number one, the piece where you started off with when you mentioned about women's fantasies, submissiveness, and wanting to be raped, I just wanted to attend to that really quick for a moment. Was my first point is that my take is that women want to be wanted and want to be taken, not raped. Really important for me to make that point, not actually raped. Okay. Number two, shall I move on?
Yes, I
okay,
get that.
Okay, thank you. Yep. Okay. So number two, when Barbara and Shannon were talking, there was a perspective about that it's not the goal to be a house husband is what they seem to discover from that classroom study that they did. And indeed, what it seems to be is that for women, many women, they desire to have it all and be it all. And it's not men's desire per se, their intentions originally to be a house husband. What's happened is women are in such overdrive as individuals professionally. And that's not a bad thing, but we want it all. We want kids. We want to grow individually professionally. We want the attentive husband, the available father, and the masculine man. And so what's happened is masculinity, marriage, all in a state of redefinition of what marriage actually is and what being a man is and what women want men to be. So that leads us into point number three. Let's go with what Frank was talking about, the whole stay-at-home role. Now, he shared his story and was so brave as to share that his sex life suffered when the role had shifted, which is very much in sync with what Reed's philosophy was about, that a man is a man and a woman is a woman. But when I listened to that, I then heard what Tim said, the whole house spouse concept, and he found a woman who, it's not about a man is a man, a woman is a woman. It's rather about him finding in his second relationship a woman that really valued the house spouse. And it sounded like she really wanted that. And in essence, he feels good. He feels sexy. He feels good about who he is because she feels good about who she is, which really then leads us into the next point, which is Dr. Zach's take when he had talked about that it's a sexy turn-on when somebody cares for us. He talked about the love chemical moving us to long-term connection and care. And so then where does that leave us? If we put this all together, and then Dr. Lee ended with peace, he said a lot as well, but one point I took from him, amongst all of the points, to kind of put this all together in a package is, he said being desired by someone who is aroused by you is sexy. So put all this together, and I see a theme. The theme with everybody and their different perspectives and their own unique twist, the main theme seems to be, from my analysis anyway, is it's not the arrangement, house husband or no house husband. It's how the individual and how the couple as a couple unit views and handles whatever their marital arrangement is, plus being mindful of what your desires are, plus choosing to grow and enhance in your relationship. If you want it to be a monogamous, sexy, passionate relationship, it can be. But if you're open to something else, then that's what some people end up choosing. But I have seen time and time again, you can have this package in a monogamous relationship if you are mindful and attentive and the two of you can dialogue about what it is that you're each feeling and you're invested and interested in continuing to grow your sexual style through the years, as it will change and it will shift. And it's not necessarily going to be what it was 5 or 10 years ago, and people get stuck in their old rut. So they look outside for passion when you can find something new right in front of you.
Okay, so now you have to talk about this. I'm going to leave the morals out of it. You know, these couples that are able to...
Wait a minute. I said sure, and then I thought, why are we leaving the morals out of it? But okay,
well,
go ahead.
Because I'm going to just, like, strip the morals away, because when people put the morals in it, it's like there's no other way but one man, one woman, and that's it forevermore. You're supposed
sure.
to when you're 7 and die when you're 9. Never think or look at anybody else, and that's just not the way it really goes. But there are these couples that get into the situation where they're okay with outside liaisons. I remember we had a guest, Holly Hill, I want to say. She wrote Sugar Babes and basically talked about being in a relationship where they had what they called negotiated infidelity, where they helped each other decide that we're going to have liaisons outside. Let's talk about what is comfortable for our relationship, okay? And so that was a very up to me, an upscale way of kind of being a swinger. They're not married, but they're like, this is our primary relationship. We're going to make it work for us, but there's going to be other people outside. What is it that makes these couples be able to deal with it? Because I'm going to say one other thing. I once met this couple, became friends with a couple who I became friends with them because I looked at them, and I was going through my divorce at the time and not being treated so hot. And I looked at how kind these two people were to each other. And they had been married over 25 years, okay? And they were just so nice and kind to each other. I had never seen, I feel like, anybody be this nice to each other, including having been in this, you know, I've been in this religious church environment. I'm just telling you, I've never seen people treat each other this way. Then come to find out that the wife's bisexual and that they're swingers, it just blew my mind. Blew my mind! Because I'm just like, okay, you have all these people who are supposed to be moral, who are treating each other like crap, and you have these two people who are living their relationship outside of the confines of what we say it should be, yet when you see them talk and act and treat each other, it's better than I've seen practically in anyone. What allowed people to be able to come to that comfort level? Because I think anybody feels like, I'm going to lose my primary relationship if I say I want to introduce someone else. How do couples get there? How does that happen?
Well, typically what happens is it's one person that initiates this. And often the person that initiates it is because they themselves have not been feeling fully fulfilled in their relationship. They love the person that they're with. They care about the person that they're with, but they're not fully fulfilled. And so their desire of completing, or I should say filling, what the void is that they're feeling, and they go outside, and often they end up being with somebody, and it is considered an affair at first, where then, and this is not always the case, but this is very often, that then the spouse ends up finding out about it, and then there's a dialogue to be had about that they love the person. They don't want the marriage to end, but that they love being with this other person too. They want the primary relationship and another relationship as well. And what happens is the spouse either is open to this exploratory process or is not. And if the spouse is open to this as well, then this then becomes, for the couple, a polyamorous relationship. If the spouse is not open to it, then often eventually over time it ends up leading to a divorce, or the person puts up with it for however long, until they get to the point where they're just very unhappy, feeling like they're second best, and then they end up disconnecting and the relationship doesn't continue. So usually it's one person and then it ends up becoming two. Now, there are times where there is a community of people who already know, because they've had these types of experiences, that really they want to have a polyamorous lifestyle, and they will seek out other people who have a similar belief system to them. But usually it takes time to get to that belief system, to understand that that's even what you feel, because you've gone through maybe even many relationships where you're never feeling full, you're never feeling whole, and it's when you start to realize, I want to be with other people too, you start to discover, hey, there's other people out there that feel the same way as well. But when you're talking about this specific couple, who I don't know who they are particularly, if they fall under the more often than not category where they've been married for a long time, which you did mention that, and if one of them ended up seeking outside, and that then led up to a dialogue and then a decision because they love each other. And I will say, Dr. Veronica, when you mentioned how nice and kind they are to each other, let's be mindful of, they're not nice and kind to each other because there's, you know, an outside of the considered norm. Of course, I know you know this, but I can't help myself but to mention anyway, that's sure. Not why they're nice to each other. There are people who are nice to each other that are monogamous, and there are people who are nice to each other that, you know, live a polyamorous lifestyle. It's just because they live that lifestyle doesn't mean that they're not nice, or because they don't. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but, you know, you're taught that people who live outside of the traditional one man, one woman relationship are bad people. That's just how we were taught. And, I mean, no,
right.
That's
and
not
you know,
true.
You know
people
what?
Are
yeah,
all kinds of people, but this is how we're taught to think, especially in the confines
right.
of, I'm not going to have time to talk to somebody like Reed anymore who writes romance life, but from the conservative side of things, that's what you're taught, that this is a downfall of society, things are going to fall apart, the world's ending, this is what we read about the end times in the Bible, all the other kind of discussion.
Well,
and so you think that these are the people who are leading a revolution of horribleness, and then on the other side you look and say, well, these are some of the nicest people I've ever met in my life. And then to find out, wow, this is the other side of them, there's just a dissonance. It's a disconnect. You understand what I'm saying.
Right. It seems like a disconnect because when somebody does something that is out of the cultural norm, you think that they fall under this umbrella or this category of wrong or evil. And it's really interesting what you're saying, because I'll tell you, when couples come in to see me that are struggling with this, you know, in my therapy practice here in Massachusetts, that one member of the couple unit is having these thoughts of how do we remain married if I want to also be with somebody else, and the other person in the couple unit is saying that's not what they signed up for. You know, 20 years later, this is not what they want. They want it just to be monogamous and to stay monogamous, and it's a very painful discussion for them, and often the question of the person who has the outside relationship is, you know, Am I horrible? Am I evil? Is there something wrong with me? Am I sick? And the question is, you're not sick. There's nothing evil or horribly wrong with you. It's rather you both have a different perspective. You're having a different perspective on what a relationship is. I will say, though, I have to share that it does concern me, though, if we were to become a culture where everybody is just having extra relationships with several other people or one or two other people in addition to their spouse, because then we become a society where there is a lack of monogamy. And it does concern me, because what then does happen to the children? If every time their mother or their father decides another relationship is going to end, often these people become a part of the children's lives. So now these children have to mourn and grieve over the loss and the loss again and then the loss again of all of these extra partners that they're never in control of, because it's always their parent ending a relationship and another relationship and another relationship. And children who have to mourn like that eventually learn there is no mourning. They just have to move on, and people are disposable. And so I am concerned about what it could lead to in terms of a disposable society and what really a relationship is. But, you know, I'm not jumping there so fast, but it would have to be explored further. But there is a concern there. I'd be more inclined to want to explore with a couple, is it possible that their couplehood could enhance and grow between the two of them, than just jumping so fast into polyamory. But I must say, there are people who come in and that's the lifestyle they want to lead, and it's not my job to tell them they shouldn't lead it or can't lead it. Certainly not. Certainly not.
Yeah, and I've also met people, see, I come across a lot of people. I've also met people who have lived that lifestyle and gone the other way. They've gone from polyamory or swinger type lifestyle to a monogamous lifestyle. They were just, that's the way we were then. Now we choose to do it this way now. And so, and long married too. So I think it can go both ways. We focus on the people where it's all open or swinger, but I think there probably are couples that as they go along in time, they grow closer together and people aren't in there. Do you see that also?
Sure. I have seen that as well, but I must say that I see much more of people who end up that they're exploring the direction of what else can they have. We seem to be more of a culture of what else, what more. But absolutely, I have seen it go the other way too, because then again, in their situation, it's, well, what can be different? What am I not getting? What can I have? Perhaps I want monogamy. But it does go more the other way, just because there's more people that are walking around in our culture believing that monogamy is acceptable and then struggling with the fact that it's not working for them, then there are people who are born into the belief system that polyamory is the way to go, and then they go to monogamy.
Yes. So I got to say thank you for that nice wrap-up. It's been an interesting show. We've gone from sort of a topic to topic. We're talking about it's a broad topic. I'm really thinking about what do women want sexually. I wanted to focus on it. There has been this hoopla about shades of gray. Do we really want men who are egalitarian in our house? Do we really want men who are going to help us? Is that something that's sexually attracted to us? And I wanted to hear the voice from the men as to what it's like to be there, and does the respect get lost? Because that's what it's all about. You got to respect the man that you're with. Does the respect get lost such that you don't feel sexually attracted to that particular person? So It's been interesting. I want to thank all our guests. Some great people. Reed, best-selling author, Dr. Lay, Dr. Zach, Mr. Oxytocin, Dr. Love. Oxytocin is great. It's a great thing. Barbara and Shannon Kelly, HuffPost bloggers. Read them in the HuffPost. They write some really good articles. Frank and Tim, who have been, let's call it house spouse. I like house spouse. Did I miss anybody, Russell?
No, I think you just about ran the list.
It's a long list. and I'll let you tell, like, did I tell you I got beat up for putting out and saying women have rape fantasies? I was saying I want people to talk, comment on women have rape fantasies. And I had somebody write in and say, how dare you say women have rape fantasies? Anyway, it's been an interesting episode of Wellness for the Real World. I want you to follow me on Twitter, Dr. Veronica, IMD. Visit drveronica.com. Generally, I ask my guests to write blogs for drveronica.com, and then they write some interesting follow-up piece. Oh, I didn't thank Dr. Karen Ruskin. Russell, I didn't thank Dr. Karen Ruskin.
Well, you thanked her before.
Okay. Well, I don't want to forget her because she was so great in doing the wrap-up, and that was hard. So Wellness for the Real World with Dr. Veronica and Russell on the side. Couldn't do it without you, Russell. I love you. Reed, keep doing what you're doing with the romance novels. We're waiting on the edge of our seats for the next installment, Wellness for the Real World with Dr. Veronica and Russell. See you next week.